This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Jetzt punktest du gegen Pigmentflecken mit der Antipigmentpflegeserie von Eucerin. Das Dualserum mit Thiamidol reduziert Pigmentflecken effektiv und beugt der Neuentstehung vor. So sorgt es für einen langanhaltend ebenmäßigen Teint mit sichtbaren Ergebnissen nach 2 Wochen. Teste jetzt das Eucerin Dualserum in deiner Apotheke und sichere dir beim Kauf eines Antipigmentprodukts eine perfektionierende Körpercreme in Reisegröße gratis dazu. Mehr Infos auf eucerin.de.
Right now, if you're in California and you Google a story from, say, the LA Times, Google might show you that news link, but it might not.
Google is performing a test, as it calls it, where it does not show some news links to some users.
That's Matt Pierce, a former LA Times journalist who's now the president of the Media Guild of the West. Google's so-called test, blocking some links to California news organizations, is in response to a state bill the company opposes.
The California Journalism Preservation Act, which proposes to force companies like Google and Meta to pay publishers for the journalism that journalists like me produce.
So each time big tech shows you that link or social media post, some money would go back into the newsroom or TV station that produced it. Right now, publishers get web traffic, but that's it. The companies do not want this bill to pass, hence the blocking. But people like Matt, a journalist turned union leader, see it as a way to help save journalism, or at least share a little profit. You know, I've known your work for some time. I followed it at the LA Times. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about why you got involved in advocating for this bill and how that transition feels.
I got involved because I love the Los Angeles Times. I was a Los Angeles Times lifer, so to speak. It was my first job coming out of journalism school back in 2012. Made me the journalist I am today. It's filled with many amazing reporters, Pulitzer winners, investigative journalists, people who really taught me how to do the craft. It's one of the great institutions of American journalism. But as I worked there over the past decade, it became increasingly clear to me that the place was falling into neglect.
Even a new billionaire owner who invested in journalism couldn't seem to stop the bleeding. Matt is one of several journalists who recently took a buyout and left the paper.
The LA Times newsroom has shrunk about 40% since 2019 through layoffs and buyouts and attrition. And what that taught me is that even in one of the best case scenarios for local journalism, we live in a wealthy city with a lot of wealthy people in it, a lot of well-educated readers, people who are interested in politics, interested in our journalism, even with some of the highest quality journalists that you could hire. It's still not a good bet for investors. You can still lose a ton of money, even in the best case scenario. And that has just taught me that the ecosystem that supports journalism, and especially local journalism in the United States, is fundamentally broken and needs reform.
Today on the show, can California force big tech to pay for journalism? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around.
Hey, everybody, it's Neil. I've got some huge news. Decoder is moving to Mondays and Thursdays. We're adding a second episode of the show. On Mondays, we'll have our classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers.
I think we're going to have to start having conversations about how do we pay those jobs that can't be done by AI.
And on Thursdays, we'll be explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show.
There's a new generation of people on the internet. Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal. They can just go to TikTok.
This is going to be really fun. I'm very excited about all this. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts now.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. Head to factormeals.com/whatnexttbd50 and use code whatnexttbd50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code whatnexttbd50 at factormeals.com/whatnexttbd50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. The California Journalism Preservation Act is one of two proposed measures aimed at getting big tech to help fund journalism. It's the brainchild of Democratic Assemblymember Buffy Wicks.
I want to start with the basics of how this bill would work. Right now, let's say I Google something or I follow a link on Facebook. You know, I see that link, I click on that link, it takes me there. No one at that news organization gets paid for that action. How would the California Journalism Preservation Act change that?
The way that local journalism used to work is that many of America's journalists worked for newspapers that were essentially local or regional advertising monopolies. Your local department store might advertise in the newspaper. Those dollars funded the salary of an investigative journalist in your town investigating the mayor. All that's gone away for a variety of reasons. But now those advertising dollars, they've become digital advertising dollars. They've become concentrated in companies like Google and Meta that use programmatic advertising. That's advertising that sort of automatically reacts to you, sometimes follows you around the internet. You go to a web page, you might see a widget on the side, runs through Google. Google captures an extraordinary amount of that revenue from that advertising, and it's not a company that itself employs journalists. So this bill proposes that under threat of third-party arbitration, Google would have to pay publishers a fair share for what they profit from the work that we feed to their services that they sell ads against.
And then publishers would, what, reinvest that money or 70% of that money into journalism jobs? That's part of this idea?
This bill is unique in that it requires news publishers to reinvest 70% of that money back into the journalists who created that work in the first place, because I don't know if people have noticed, but there are a lot of bad actors who now own local news companies in our communities. Alden Global Capital, it's a famous hedge fund that's bought a lot of local newsrooms and gutted them. Gannett, it's a famous national news chain that owns a lot of local news outlets backed by private equity Fortress Investment Group.
It can't benefit the hedge funds.
Can't just benefit the hedge funds, that's right.
Why do you think this is all coming to a head now? Because media companies have been struggling for years, big declines in ad revenue, layoffs, newsrooms being gutted. What's happened that made this happen now?
I think it's a confluence of factors. First among them is that we're a couple decades deep into the platform revolution, and something that you will hear in the journalism world quite a bit, or people who think a lot about journalism or media, is that, you know, we have to find new ways to meet the audiences where they are. You didn't just have to go buy a print newspaper or type in the URL to go find one of my stories. You know, here's this new technology, this new amazing platform where, you know, there's new ways of distributing news to the public. Sounds great, but the reality of that is, and I think the reason why things are coming to a head, is that we now understand in hindsight that a lot of that stuff just fundamentally does not pay the bills. So it's been kind of a raw deal for newsrooms. You know, we've been trying to innovate for the past 10 or 20 years. We've been trying to be different, trying new ways of connecting with readers, using TikTok, using Instagram, live streaming, podcasting. We have tried everything, and so much of it has failed.
Back in, say, 2005, most journalists saw platforms as a new way, maybe the way, to reach audiences. So just about every newsroom mastered the art of search engine optimization, figuring out how to package this or that story so that it did well on this or that platform. Facebook, Twitter, whatever got you the most traffic. BuzzFeed News was great at this. So was Vice. Both have since gutted their newsrooms. Fundamentally, the traffic bet didn't pay off, especially when platforms started to de-emphasize news. Matt argues there's another change at work now.
I think the internet that we grew up with, for those of us born in the 20th century, the internet of hyperlinks where you just sat in a browser and you sort of coasted from website to website, like, I think that internet is going away. We're no longer sort of like hunter-gatherers of the information, like coasting around from news site to news site, like typing in, you know, nytimes.com in the browser and going and seeing what's on the homepage. If you're listening to the show right now, like, think about how you use your phone. Like, how often are you using apps instead of a browser already? Like, this is the direction of internet development, is to park people in one place. Meta just introduced on its services in Instagram, AI-assisted search. So the idea of, like, leaving Instagram, Meta's trying to make that harder.
Sure, they want to keep you in their product universe.
Yes, because you could sell more ads against it. We're building a bigger and better and more perfect casino. And that is really great if you're Meta. That is really great if you're Google. These companies are developing right out in the open a different kind of internet where you don't really go anywhere. You just sit on their services. And they will still bring journalism of a form to you, whether it's attributed to those journalists or those outlets or not. It will seem to come to you anyway. And I think that's part of the bigger problem here, is that not only has the relationship between journalism and big tech become unbalanced, we've gotten to a point where even the pretense that journalists and news publishers were getting something out of this exchange of referral traffic and social media traffic from Facebook and Google searches, like, they're already building a different kind of internet where they'll take from your work and they'll summarize it for users. And then that'll be that. And that's what this sort of legislation tries to address.
Part of me wonders if this bill is, you know, a bit of wish casting from publishers who ignored that the internet, most notably Facebook and Google, were eating their lunch in terms of ad revenue. Like, some way to rectify a mistake that they made.
Well, if you're going to tell me that publishers made bad business decisions as the president of a labor union, I'm going to agree with you. Nobody loves mocking and ridiculing and criticizing news publishers more than I do. And God knows that there are a lot of them that have made some really bad mistakes. And that's why we exist and why we yell at them. But the issue is that I find it hard to believe. The skeptic in me finds it hard to believe the idea that a sector-wide failure of so many different types of news companies across so many different types of mediums, with so many different management teams, with so many different editorial focuses, making so many different business decisions, could all arrive at the same location of failure. That, to me, says that there is a systemic issue here. And the problem with a systemic issue, a systemic weakness in this industry, is that even when you have a mediocre company that doesn't innovate, even when you have a, you know, a sort of slow management team that doesn't get with the times, often those decisions or those management teams and that kind of bumbling is fatal in a normal business sector. The problem is that when the economy gets so unforgiving for this type of company to survive, the margin for error gets so much lower.
Google and Meta, as you know, call this a link tax. And the argument that the companies make is that this might be helpful for big media, legacy media. Those are the links that get surfaced the most often. They see this as benefiting the bigger companies, but not necessarily smaller publishers, local newspapers, local TV. So some local news organizations oppose the bill. What do you think of that response?
I mean, I do find it highly amusing to see companies with market caps of $2 trillion at this point complaining about capitalism. Yes.
Right. But CalMatters, a nonprofit news organization, you know, has signed on to oppose the bill.
Yeah. And this is one of the parts where I get a little bit skeptical as a journalist as well. Within the past 5 or 10 years, Google and Meta have stepped into this power vacuum that's been left by the collapse of the economic model that supported journalism and have started directly funding a lot of newsrooms themselves. CalMatters is one of those newsrooms that gets a lot of funding from tech. And this is not me saying that CalMatters is acting in bad faith if it says that it's going to criticize legislation like this.
It sounds like that's what you're saying.
It's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if you're a small publisher and if you're a nonprofit publisher in particular, like CalMatters, you're dependent on grants just to survive. Like, you need this money. You need grant money wherever you can get it. And a lot of the time that you're out there raising money, I mean, the last 4 shops that have joined my local have all been nonprofit newsrooms. The journalists at these nonprofit newsrooms see how tenuous the funding situation is and how precarious their existences are, and they want some union protections. The thing is, it's like, we have also been talking about in this same space having philanthropy step up to the plate and help subsidize newsrooms. And the reality is that Google and Meta in that space have been some of those philanthropists stepping up and funding predominantly smaller newsrooms. And in many cases, in other countries, also providing money to journalist associations so that they're not going to step up there and do what I'm doing right now and criticize those same companies. So I think some of the skepticism of this legislation from the perspective of a small publisher is not irrational. Like, these are laws that threaten to upend the ecosystem as it currently exists, where newsrooms do have a symbiotic relationship with big tech. And I'm sitting here arguing that it's been a bad one.
Coming up, Australia and Canada tried this. How's it going over there?
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets. If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
There is precedent for what California is trying. Both Australia and Canada passed similar laws and played similar games of chicken with Google and Meta. For more than a week in 2021, Australians saw no news links on their Facebook feeds. Google threatened to cut off the whole country. But eventually, the Australian government prevailed, and Google and Meta struck deals with several news organizations. The Canadian picture
is a little more complicated. Google compromised with the Canadian government last year, but Meta didn't, and news links are still blocked on Canadian Facebook and Instagram feeds.
We still don't fully know how the Canadian deal is playing out, right? It was last year. We're still learning. There was a drop in traffic for many Canadian publishers. I think it's unclear whether that results in a drop in revenue. I wonder if that worries you.
It does worry me, but I think the story is a little bit incomplete because I believe the Canadian publishers are going to start getting their first payments from Google, I believe, in June or July. So that's not like a one-sided transaction there where publishers only lose Facebook traffic and then get nothing in return. Like, there will be financial compensation coming to Canadian newsrooms very soon. And it's just like, as of this taping, we haven't seen that yet. So it's really hard to sort of evaluate, like, was that a good bargain or not? So I will say that, like, that's really a question mark, specifically for the Canadians. And I think how people feel about that is going to depend on what do these cash infusions from Google directly to Canadian newsrooms look like.
You and I care a lot about this, think a lot about this. You know, I've been a journalist for more than 20 years now. Do other people care? Because I think your casual news consumer might not think a lot about the economics of the media business or how tech intersects with it. Why should they care?
To answer this question, you have to go back to a book like Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. What Robert Putnam discovered when he was looking through time usage surveys is that generation by generation, fewer and fewer people were following the news more closely. So we are actually the victims of this dynamic. And I say victims, and I mean that in a democratic sense, in the sense as a functioning republic, this historical tidal wave of inertia. People not caring about their communities, people joining fewer civic associations, people having less awareness of what's going on around them. This is something that no single bill to massively fund journalism jobs is going to fix. Like, we are talking about a fundamental democratic problem in America. Our enemy, our disconnectedness from each other. Journalists, newspapers were just one of the many institutions that used to knit civic life in the United States together. Trade unions were another one of those. So I kind of see this issue from multiple directions. And journalism is just one of those several civic pillars that have been eroding over the past century. And so we're just one piece of a much bigger puzzle. And it's going to be the work of a lifetime to try to fix a lot of these issues.
You've reported on governments for a long time. Does it feel weird getting the government involved in funding journalism?
Well, on one level, as a journalist, it's like definitely weird for me to be engaged in this process.
That's not what we're trained to do.
It's not what we're trained to do. You know, I'm trained to be independent from these people. That is the reality. And like, I still have all that training and those instincts in me that kind of grate all the time that I'm working on this stuff. But there is this like this other version of the story for journalism we kind of like don't talk about as much anymore, because we all drank the libertarian Kool-Aid for the past half century when journalism was super profitable and journalists like did not have to worry about how the work got paid for. We are not in that place anymore. So some of this is the house burning down and people like me grabbing buckets of water. But also, like, America has a long history of making public policy to support journalism. The founding fathers supported postal subsidies for the early American newspapers because they believed that in order to have a functioning republic, you had to have a somewhat educated public able to talk about the government that they had just won. It's just that we had gotten lulled into complacency by the business model of the 20th century, where we were fat on advertising profits and we just did not have to think about this stuff, and we didn't. But I think we have to think about it now, because if we don't step up to the plate and say, this is what we need, this is what journalism needs to survive, look, either somebody else is going to be making those rules who have no idea what they're doing, or no one's going to be making those rules at all. And we will just be living in a vast wasteland of paranoia, conspiracy theories, misinformation, or just emptiness.
Matt Pearce, I want to thank you for your time and for coming on today.
It was such a pleasure to be here.
Matt Pearce is a journalist and the president of the Media Guild of the West. And that is it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell, Patrick Fort, Anna Phillips, and Shayna Roth. Our show is edited by Paige Osborne. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate, and TBD is part of the larger What Next family. And if you like what we are doing here, the single best way to support us is to join Slate Plus. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. All right, we'll be back next week with more episodes. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.